University will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And I want to ask you this. Do the people of Oregon have the right to overrule the decisions of our government masters? And I want you to take this seriously. This involves a case in point, but it could involve almost any community. We're talking about a town called North Plains, an area called North Plains that's a very small community. There are only about 3,400 people who live there. And a lot of people have moved there. I don't have any direct dog in the fight. I don't know anybody who lives in North Plains. But I understand what they are up against. They've moved to a small town. They like the small town. And then along comes Tina Kotek, governor of the state of Oregon. And Tina Kotek says, you are going to expand your town. I am telling you, you're going to do this. Now, a small amount of this is about housing, but most of it is about economic development that I'm sure would benefit the community of North Plains. That's not the question. The question is, do the people there have a right to vote? And Governor Kotek has said to them, you have no right to vote and decide not to do this. We are telling you, you must do this. I'll get into the details of that. And I'll prove it to you. This is what they're doing. But first, welcome to the program. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you disagree with my point of view or my conclusions, well, then you're a naysayer. And we put naysayers right to the head of the list. If you want to dial in, that's easy enough to do. You can also vote in our X poll. We used to call it the Twitter poll. Now it's the poll on X. Does Apple really have a monopoly on the smartphone market? Well, the Biden DOJ and 16 different states, including the states of Oregon and Washington, have filed suit. Idaho did not join in. Now, I don't happen to be part of the Apple cult. I owned an Apple iPhone for a short time about, 15 years ago. I didn't particularly like it, so I went right back to Android, which is where I started. So I have a little bit of a bias. And just to understand where we sit in America right now, about half the cell phones in America are iPhones. So Apple has a really good position. The other half of the phones are not iPhones, but it's about a 50-50 split nationwide. Now, worldwide, the picture is entirely different. About 75% of phones worldwide run on the Android operating system. Only about 25% of the phones on planet Earth operate on the Apple system. So Apple has a lot more dominance in the United States, but still they're only 50% of the marketplace. But the DOJ and 16 different states, including, as I said, Washington and Oregon, have filed suit, and they say that Apple is monopolizing the smartphone market. So I'd ask it to you this way. Does Apple really have a monopoly on the smartphone market, given that you can choose dozens of different, maybe even hundreds. I haven't counted recently. Who cares, really, most days of the week? You've got so many choices when it comes to smartphones. You don't have to own an Apple smartphone. But the DOJ and the 16 states have now sued Apple for monopolizing smartphones. I don't agree with that. I would say no, and I've already disclosed I have an Android, not one of the cult phones. So answer the poll on X at Lars Larson Show, and it's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now let me get back to North Plains, and let me tell you why you ought to care about this, because this is about whether you give the government permission to govern. The consent of the governed, as it says in America's founding documents, or whether the government turns to citizens and says, you will do it the way we tell you to do it, And if you don't, there will be consequences and you won't like it. Does the government tell the people what to do, or do the people instruct the government what to do? In North Plains, this little town, it's just west of Portland, if you know where it is, but it's 3,400 people in a community. And they knew this was coming at them. So they did what Oregon's Constitution spells out. They said, let's put it on the ballot. Let's vote on it in May. But you see, Tina Kotek believes that she is Queen Kid Tina Kotek of the state of Oregon. She has a bill that was passed by the legislature. It is retroactive, meaning they have gone back in time and taken away the right of citizens in that community to vote on whether or not to dramatically expand their community. They want to bring something like 800 additional acres into that community. And it turns out that an awful lot of it may end up going to big commercial warehouses and data centers. There's a lot of ag land out there. Now, I've argued before that I think Oregon's land use system is absolutely insane. It's been in place for just over 50 years, first put there by Senate Bill 100 back in 1973. For perspective, I was in junior high at the time. And they said, oh, only if the government tells you how your land may be used will we have a productive place. Well, they've had this in place for a long time. And if you talk to most Democrats like Tina Kotek, they'll be happy to tell you why the government must dictate to people how they're allowed to use their land. That means if you're a farmer and somebody comes along and says, hey, you got 100 acres, I'd like to build houses on it, I'll pay you some money for it. You're not allowed to do it unless your government masters say it's okay. But in this case, government has now decided we're going to force this development on a small community. And when the community said, well, tell you what, we're going to put it on the ballot and see whether the people in this community want that to happen, what did Tina Kotek do? She said, I'm not going to listen to you. I don't have to listen to you. I don't have to let you vote. And in fact, the House Bill 4026, which is now, it's got bipartisan support, I'll say that. But this is a bunch of people in Salem. They represent the whole state, as Tina Kotek is supposed to represent the whole state. They've just summarily decided, number one, you will take the expansion of your town, whether you like it or not. And number two, we're not even going to let you put it to a vote. They canceled the vote for May 21. So the citizens will not be allowed to vote. And I would ask you, when you hear all these government folks who say, we're going to have public meetings, we're going to take public testimony, why, you can write an email, you can come to a public meeting, you can speak out, you can tell us what you want. I can count at least a dozen instances in the last few years where the public shows up en masse and says, we don't want this. And you know what the government does? It says, we're going to do it anyway. Because we know better than you do, and you don't have a right to vote. The last time that citizens were allowed to vote on light rail was a long, long time ago, and I don't expect they'll ever let that vote happen again. For the most part, government has decided, and this applies to Washington State too, that when citizens vote against something, while you're running counter to the wiser decisions of your government masters, we won't let that happen. This is just the latest example. People in North Plains said, we want this on the ballot. They signed the petitions. They followed the process spelled out in Oregon's Constitution. And now Queen Kotek has taken that decision from them. It's Thursday, Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network on remote this week from Stanford University and the Hoover Institution. Hey, let me tell you about my friends at American Financing. They're a family-owned mortgage company that's been around 25 years. They're saving homeowners just...
Actually is.
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say it.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, Fish Wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
If you want the very best evidence that City of Portland officials expect Donald Trump to win the presidency again, we got it this week. The city's police bureau is planning to counter election year riots again. If you lived through them as I did, you remember the arson, the looting, even the murder that dominated the news most of 2020, and the comedic TV news anchors declaring all those riots to be mostly peaceful. You might recall feckless Ted Wheeler, mayor of Portland, who paved the way for the chaos with his laissez-faire attitude toward Antifa and BLM. Why, Ted even joined the rioters in the streets until he got a face full of tear gas. So the Portland Police Bureau is working hard, so far unsuccessfully, to recruit a riot squad. PPB even ginned up a new name because they don't want to call it the Riot Squad. And apparently the old name, Rapid Response Team, seemed too militaristic to City Hall. It's now called the Public Order Team. It kind of figures that the acronym is POT Team. Maybe that'll make it more popular with the 420 crowd. With that name, it could be a new competitor for Uber Eats. From inside the police bureau, I hear that they're having trouble recruiting officers to volunteer for this duty. And you can understand why. You get a little teeny bit more pay, and you stand a great chance of being sued, disciplined, or even fired from your job for doing your job. Many of the really tough cops that I've known have long since fled PPB. Good luck getting this new woke PC DEI CRT crowd to sign up for that kind of duty. Our question of the day, this one comes in from Jeff. Hey, Lars, my auto insurance jumped another 30% over the last 6 months. Nearly $200 a month for a 56-year-old is crazy. Clean record, Portland address, no other drivers. When is this going to end? Well, when you get real law enforcement and real prosecution and real consequences for criminals, it'll probably go down. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the medical community in the Northwest and also to the state of Oregon and the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, that's Therese Bottomley's Oregon Live, because they proudly announced today more people facing terminal illness ended their lives in 2023 or under Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, otherwise known as doctor-assisted suicide, more deaths than in any previous year. The Oregon Health Authority reports 367 people. That's one suicide every day. Got the prescription to die under the law, up from 304 in 2022. The law, established about 25 years ago, a little over that, is available to patients who meet certain conditions, including having less than 6 months to live. Although, I might point out that most of us who know somebody who gets a terminal diagnosis, oftentimes they'll be told, you have about 2 years left, and then they live for five. So when you say, Doc, how much time do I have? And he says, I think it's about 6 months. Might be 2 years, but it might be 6 months. And then you take your own life. Terrible consequences. And I know there are people who like doctor-assisted suicide. I don't. I see how they're beginning to use it in Canada. We're talking about even organ transplants and doctor-assisted suicide for both the mentally ill and mentally handicapped. I don't think any of that is a good idea, but that's just me. Our best email so far today comes in from Paul McGowan, Master Gunnery Sergeant, U.S. Marine Corps, retired. Lars, I find it interesting that your naysayer yesterday, Santiago, said that none of the news was reporting on the findings of the Biden impeachment hearings. My wife and I like to listen to David Muir on ABC for evening news on occasion. I watched it with her last night to see what they say about the congressional hearings, knowing it's not hard for you to believe the topic wasn't even mentioned in the entire 30 minutes. The general population, better known as the uninformed voter by the late, great Rush Limbaugh, get their opinions tainted by the likes of ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and of course MSNBC. They get one side of the news, the liberal left side, state-run media's opinion, and that's what they use as their pre-vote research prior to casting a ballot. I just hope that the Northwest keeps on listening. We need now Donald Trump more than ever before. Signed, Paul McGowan. And Paul, thank you very much for your service in the United States Marine Corps. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And let me start with Larry. Larry, you heard me mention North Plains. You heard me mention that the governor of the state has said she will dramatically expand their community and she will not let the people in that town take a vote on that. What should we make of that?
Well, first off, I'm not a fan of the governor and I'm not a fan of land use. But I doubt that any of the people that don't want the expansion own the land that will be the subject of the expansion.
Probably
so
true.
I find interesting that those citizens have their knickers in a knot because they can't tell somebody else what to do with their land.
I don't like people telling other folks what to do with their land. I mean, some zoning, some regulation is okay. You don't want to put a sewage treatment plant next to an apartment complex, a park, or a school. I get that. But we've had 50 years in the state of Oregon of this crazy land use system, which we're told is so it needs to stay inviolate, that you can't do it, that without it, the whole state would be covered by shopping malls. I've never actually believed that was true. But now, all the people who used to tell you we have to have this land use system to make everything predictive, they're the ones who are now saying, no, now we have to take the wraps off and tell a small town, you must expand. Should the people in that town have a say?
Is that expansion going to happen within the city limits or is it outside
the city limits? They're going to do is expand the urban growth boundary. So it isn't the city limits now, but it sounds like it will be at some point in the future. And, of course, the government of North Plains, this tiny town, is saying, yeah, add 800 acres of new land with stuff on it that costs a lot of money and we'll be glad to tax it. They're anticipating that that's what they're going to do. They'll get more money to build roads and everything else. But if you move to a small town and you say, I moved here because of the nature of where this place is, that it is a small town, do you want somebody else deciding from outside, you must expand because we say so?
Fair argument, but then if I was going to move to a small town and try to avoid growth, I wouldn't be in the Portland area. I mean, especially Washington County, that's the economic engine of the state. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think what should happen is the government should get rid of Senate Bill 100, wipe out the land use laws, all the crazy urban growth boundary and all that. Because I've always told people what urban growth boundaries do is they do to land what OPEC did to oil. You artificially constrain the supply of something, you drive the price through the roof, and if you noticed, right now to build a house, you have to buy a piece of land that has had its price artificially driven up by government action. Then you have to go to the government and pay them as much as $100,000 in fees before you're allowed to build a house on your land. I don't like any of that, but if they're going to get rid of it, they shouldn't just get rid of it for one town. They should get rid of it for the whole state and change that. But the governor wants to have her way, and it sounds like she doesn't want citizens going down and casting a ballot to tell the government that they're wrong. And the Constitution does provide for that. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We're live at the Hoover Institution broadcast studios on the Stanford campus. And sitting here in the studio with me is Dr. Scott Atlas, medical doctor, senior fellow at Hoover, former chief of neuroradiology at Stanford University Medical Center, and a guy who writes in the Wall Street Journal. We could hit a couple of things, but you and I were talking about free speech in this country. Where do we stand right now?
Well, thanks for having me, Lars. You know, I think this is really one of the most disastrous outcomes, or at least things that were exposed by the pandemic. I think there are a lot of issues that were plaguing our society that we weren't really aware of, but one is the speech censorship, because the real solution to misinformation, false information, bad information is more information. That's the only solution. No one should or really can trust anyone else to determine what should be allowed to be said. I mean, I think this is the most fundamental basis of all free societies, and frankly, what's frightening is that apparently we don't live in a free society right now. I mean, I do a lot of international traveling, a lot of international speaking, and the countries that we held up as being horrible examples of imposing on freedom, the countries that had propaganda-based media, that censored people, that attacked political opposition and people who said dissident views, we are now that country.
Except we're the biggest country, the most prosperous country on the planet, and we should lead by example, shouldn't we?
Well, I mean, people, as you know, Lars, I mean, I'm from a family of immigrants, and I think when we say the country was built on immigrants, immigrants came here because of freedoms. They didn't come here to replicate what they fled from. So, you know, it's very dangerous when you hear a Supreme Court justice say that, oh, the problem with the First Amendment is that it limits the government. I mean, this is really a shocking betrayal of what the most fundamental freedoms are in this country.
Well, the other thing that she said, I read a bunch of the decision, the arguments that were given this week in Murphy versus Missouri, and she says, well, the government has free speech rights. And I actually reject that idea. I don't think the government has free speech rights any more than if you had a young resident studying under you, and he says, I can say anything I want. And you say, well, as long as I'm your boss, no, you can't say anything. And the government is supposed to serve the people, and when the servants of the people start telling the people, shut up, we'll tell you how things are going to be, that relationship is gone, isn't it?
Well, you know, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I don't pretend to be one. But, you know, the basic premise of the Constitution is to outline what the government does. And if it's not in there, they don't have that responsibility or right. But really, the country was founded on freedom. I mean, this is sort of, you know, so obvious. I don't even know why it needs to be said. And, you know, without freedom of speech, you cannot have a free exchange of ideas. And without the free exchange of ideas, you can't even arrive at the truths that we need as a society. And, you know, one of the problems that has been exposed by the pandemic, besides the lack of freedom of speech, is the power of the cancel culture. And this is a form of censorship, and I think this is something that needs to be spoken about. Censorship is not just overt. There's a lot of nuance to it, and it was very impactful and very harmful to the public good when you have demonization of opposing views and therefore an illusion of a consensus because people are canceling themselves because of the cost of speaking out. I think this is very, very harmful. I think we need to encourage the free speech, not just through the courts, but through our own actions. We can't have a functional society. We can't have a moral society if we're not allowing the free discussion of ideas. And we really can't have a unified citizenry if we divide people and start demonizing everyone who disagrees with us.
I'm talking to Dr. Scott Atlas from the Hoover Institution and also Stanford, but do you think you got because you were a victim of cancel culture, were you canceled more because of what you were saying about the pandemic and your medical advice and suggestions, or because you were trying to help the current president at that time, President Trump?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and there's two parts to it, of course. But the first part, in March of 2020, there were three of us who independently spoke out against lockdowns because they were harmful and they wouldn't work and they were destroying people and not protecting the elderly at risk. In March of 2020, I wrote a piece, Johnny Anides of Stanford wrote a piece independently, and David Katz wrote a piece in the New York Times. And then later in the spring, we all independently testified to the House, to the Senate Subcommittee on Homeland Security that lockdown should end and were destructive. And this was not necessarily canceled in the spring and summer. I did a bunch of interviews. I then, in late July, was asked by the Trump White House to come in and help the country as an advisor to the president. I'm not a political person. And only then did the real vicious attacks on me begin. So, yes, it was harmful to speak out against the narrative, but reality, looking back, there were three of us at Stanford, myself, John Ioannidis, and Jay Bhattacharya, all of whom said the exact same things about lockdowns didn't work, about children's schools should be open, about they were destroying kids who had very, very low risk, about we should increase the protection of elderly, about how masks don't work, et cetera, et cetera. But only one of us got the censure from the faculty senate at Stanford. And that's obvious. It's because I stood next to President Trump, who the Stanford people don't approve of and many of whom despise. And I'm trying to help the country, particularly for these people who were elderly on the Stanford Faculty Senate, frankly, ironically. It's very sad when you're attacked for trying to help the country just because you're standing next to a president who many people, don't approve of. And I think that's a new low. I was naive. I thought facts mattered. I thought that you're supposed to help your country when people are dying and when people are incompetent are advising your president. It's a very sad state of affairs. It didn't stop me, and it doesn't stop somebody like me for a variety of reasons, including my own personality and my own sense of right and wrong. But it did stop many, many other people, hundreds of medical scientists all over the country, including people at Stanford, including people in the medical school's Department of Infectious Disease, told me personally or emailed me they were afraid for their own careers and for their own families, so they weren't stepping up and speaking out. And I think this is a very critical issue here. When this cancel culture happens, it does two things. It stops individuals from speaking up, but it also stops everyone from hearing the information. And that means that there's this creation of a false consensus. The public is confused about what to believe. And it's a very, very sad state of affairs when our country destroys itself partly for political hatred.
Have you figured out whether the institutions that made all those mistakes over the last 4 years have course corrected to say we can't do it that way again?
Well, they haven't made those mistakes because, the trust, as you're alluding to here, has been destroyed. Two-thirds of people about 60% think that science is not to be trusted. The FDA and the CDC, only 40% of Americans think they're good or institutions, and this has been plummeting over the past few years. So we need, first and foremost, a public demand for an admission of error, because as we know in our personal lives, when you're wrong, the first step in restoring trust is to say you were wrong. But there's a lot more to it than that. They have not admitted this, and we have a long way to go.
Dr. Atlas, I got a heart break. Can you stick through
the
break? Thank you very much. Dr. Scott Atlas is with me. We're here at the Hoover Broadcast Studios. We'll be back in just a moment. Plan to get your calls later at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Are you ready?
A message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. We're live at the Hoover Broadcast Studios, and Dr. Scott Atlas is with me, censured by his own university for things that I don't think he should have been censured for, but that's my opinion. Doctor, you mentioned we've got to rebuild trust in some of these institutions and the individuals who work in them, like medicine. Do you have some ideas on how to get there?
Well, I mean, this is really the step that's so essential. It's not so much about retribution of what was done. It's about how to move forward to fix things, because as I've said many times, there's a stain on public health now from the Birx-Fauci policies and from the university professors and medical scientists who weighed in and just dug in, denying all science, denying biology, and refusing now to admit that they were grossly wrong. So what do we do? And this is going to really require leadership, because frankly, we have a failure of courage in this country. We have a failure of courage among the people, and we have a failure of courage in the leadership who, you know, we noticed our political leadership who were elected, they hid behind the CDC as if they're not responsible for leading. And here's some of my initial recommendations, which I've outlined in Real Clear Politics at the end of 2023. First, we need to clearly define the term public health emergency by law. This is a term that's ambiguous, that's unending, and, you know, we can't have something like this. An emergency, by definition, is temporary, and it's only, used because we don't have time to think straight, really. So we need to impose a strict time limit, maybe 2 weeks or something, and require legislation really to extend it. We need to add term limits to these agency positions. These positions are appointed. Yes, people talk about term limits to elected officials, but what about the people who are the bureaucrats? Fauci was a bureaucrat for 38 years. I mean, it's a joke to see a picture of Anthony Fauci wearing a white lab coat. He's not a doctor, and he hasn't been a scientist for decades. Birx was basically a permanent bureaucrat for decades as well. We need term limits, not just to top positions, but to mid-level. We need to forbid drug royalty sharing by employees of these agencies. People don't understand. $300+ million of royalties were shared by NIH employees over the past decade with the drugs that they approved and evaluated. NIH, CDC, FDA employees should absolutely not have this conflict of interest in sharing payments for drugs that they approved. This is really outrageous. We need to require full transparency of the discussions at the FDA, the CDC, and NIH. As you said, Lars, earlier, these people work for us.
Yeah.
We don't work for them. We want to know what they're saying. You realize back in when the vaccines were being evaluated, the FDA advisory committee, one of the people on it said to the FDA, quote, we need to just use the vaccines on kids to figure out how safe they are. That's just how it works. That's a quote. Nobody knew that was said. I mean, it's in the record. Somehow you can dig that up. But, I mean, this is that was in October of 2021 by Eric Rubin, who is an advisor for children's COVID vaccines. That's outrageous. We need transparency. We need to restate with somehow that the CDC is not a rule setter. The CDC is a data provider. The CDC is an advisory agency. We're not supposed to be subject to any rules or mandates as a free society by the CDC. We need to decentralize the funding of research. The NIH controls all the funding, all the topics that are funded in science. We have over 15 universities that get $500 million-plus every year from the NIH, so they're going to be reluctant to speak up. But we also have to realize every university and academic scientist, their career depends on NIH grants. What kind of assistant young professor is going to have the guts to speak out against Anthony Fauci, who controls his career? I mean, these are severe, conflicts here that we need to eliminate. And lastly, I want to say this. We need to eliminate, or at least temporarily halt, all funding and all binding agreements of the World Health Organization.
I was going to bring up WHO. What about this new agreement that Biden apparently wants to have, where WHO takes control of all emergencies, not just disease emergencies, but they could declare a climate emergency or a public safety emergency or a gun emergency? Do you have... Is there any reason America should approve that kind of deal with WHO?
No sovereign nation should let a third party declare an emergency in your country. Because declaration of an emergency, a public health emergency or other emergency, necessarily is the gateway to emergency orders, to emergency
powers.
I mean, this is no sovereign nation, no free person who has a brain should want to have that done. But, you know, in addition to that pandemic accord that's being drafted behind closed doors, by the way, and yes, you're right, the Biden administration's ambassador to the WHO, has already said, we agree with and support the agreement. The agreement isn't even written in final form. This is, I don't know if dumb is a word that should be used. I mean, it's not a very eloquent way to say it. But, I mean, that's just insane. And, yes, those things are not only declaring emergencies in your country, but they take over intellectual property. They force distribution of what you developed, what your private sector developed, at a certain price. I mean, we're not, okay, there's one thing to allow that, but if your country wants to do these kinds of things, okay, that's your purview. That's not the purview of some other agency. And by the way, the U.S. is the biggest funder of the WHO. We ought to use the leverage. We're funding, you know, a massive amount. I don't know if it's, I forget.
It's 400 million,
yeah,
I think.
Hundreds
and
of
China
millions.
China gives them 50 and China runs the show.
Well, hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer money. The government,
yeah,
has no money. It's our money. Why are we just giving the money to an unaccountable agency?
Dr. Scott Atlas, it's great always to talk to you. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
That is Dr. Scott Atlas.
The Larson Show.
To continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls. I want to talk education for a moment with our friend Rick Hanushek, who is the Paul and Jean Hanna Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution here at Stanford. It's good to see you in person again.
It's always good to be back on your show.
Well, let's talk about education, because one of the things that's disappointed families and parents and, frankly, taxpayers as well, is that we had the pandemic. There were a lot of things done that a lot of us think were wrong. Shutdowns, lockdowns, closure of public schools, and it hurt the kids a lot. But the kids are not recovering and getting back to even where they were before then. Is that fair to say?
That is the complete story, is that we are way behind. Learning loss has been tremendous, and people don't pay attention to it because kids come home from schools with A's in their courses, and they say, well, we must be doing fine, and it is a disaster for the future.
Is there a way to fix it? Because I mean, I'm a non-education professional. You know the subject well, but it seems as though this is the kind of thing that a competent education system could fix.
Well, conceptually, it's straightforward to fix it. It turns out politically, it's not. The thing that we know about schools that really counts, and we really learned this in spades during the pandemic, is that good teachers count. It really makes a difference having a good teacher. We know that in-person instruction in general during the pandemic was superior to hybrid instruction, which was superior to fully remote instruction. So having a teacher around made a difference. If we wanted to deal with the learning losses, which are, as I say, really substantial, all we would try to do is make sure that the best teachers taught more kids, taught more intensively, mm-hmm, and perhaps the poorest teachers taught less intensively. So we could do that right away if anybody wanted to actually be concerned about the kids, but we haven't had much movement in that direction.
And why? You said politically it's not palatable because what? Politicians don't want to say some of the teachers who are teaching are not very good and we need them to be, and we need the good ones to be teaching more, and that they can't bring themselves to say that?
We've developed the tradition where we never want to differentiate among teachers. And it's partly a union position, but it's not entirely a union position. The administration of our school systems around the country is also in support of this, that it's much easier just to pay everybody according to their experience and degree levels as opposed to worrying about who's best and maybe upsetting some people when you say they're not doing very well.
And yet, Rick, I'm talking to Rick Hanushek from here at Hoover, and yet there are business models, and I know schools, education is a bit of a business, that suggest if you go into any institution, any company, and you say, let's identify the 5 or 10% that are the worst at our company, that contribute the least, and we simply send them on their way, say, find another job somewhere else and replace them with people who are even moderately competent, that makes a dramatic difference.
Well, that was the old Jack Welch solution. You don't have to actually go that far. You don't have to every year lop off the bottom tail, because we actually have some very good teachers in our schools and quite a few very good teachers, but we aren't willing to pay attention to who are the best and who are the worst, except for a few places. You may not know this, but Washington, D.C. and Dallas, Texas are two large school systems that have I don't know, what's the opposite of drinking the Kool-Aid, that have
rejected
the Kool-Aid and have gone to evaluating teachers and rewarding the best and not rewarding the poorest. And you see the results. Those school systems have gotten better.
How did that Dallas maybe, but how did that happen in a notoriously liberal place like Washington, D.C.?
Well, you probably remember, if I push you on this, about Michelle Rhee when she was the chancellor of the D.C. schools, and Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers Union. They were in a knockdown, drag-out battle over some time. But the Trump card, well, first, Adrian Fenty, the mayor, entered into it, but Congress rather controls what goes on in D.C.
True.
And they, as I understand it, legislated that you could only negotiate over pay and benefits and not other things in the D.C. schools. And so ultimately that prevailed, and they went to a system that really rewarded big time the best teachers, and they've fired 500 or 600 teachers over the years. This has been in a place for a dozen years.
Okay, can I interject? If that happened, in your business, you keep an eye on what people are doing in your field. When that happens, and the effect is that dramatic, a positive effect, why aren't the other schools around America saying they're doing it that way in D.C., we need to do it that way here?
Isn't that a good question? We don't see it just being picked up, even though the results are pretty clear that it has helped the kids in D.C. Dallas, Texas, I have to finish the D.C. story first. As this new contract came into place, Michelle Rhee left the D.C. schools, and with four subsequent chancellors, they have kept that system in D.C., which is perhaps a little surprising given your question about why hasn't it been picked up elsewhere. In Dallas, a person named Mike Miles came in and really thought through how to organize and run a school system. He spent, I think, 3 years convincing the school board there to do it. He did not have as strong a union opposition because Texas doesn't have collective bargaining, but they do have unions.
Yeah.
And he put it into place, and just as it was coming into place, he left the Dallas schools, but it stayed in place. And the unique thing about Dallas is that they replace the entire salary schedule. It wasn't just an add-on for good people and so on. They replaced the entire schedule. So right now, teachers in Dallas are paid quite closely to what they contribute to learning.
That sounds like a great idea. Rick, I appreciate the time. I'm up against a hard break, but I thank you so much for coming on. We always look forward to talking to you.
Thanks for having me on, as always.
That is Rick Hanuschek from the Hoover Institution here at Stanford University. We'll be back in a moment. I'll be glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
If we've learned anything from the headlines, it's that unexpected things happen too often. Those in charge say everything's
And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
You hear all that yelling and that screaming? Yeah, that was going on in Memphis, Tennessee last night, and I had to get one of our friends on to talk about what happened at that incident. As Kyle Rittenhouse, and yes, you might recognize his name, we'll talk about Kyle because we've talked about him on this show before. He was there to make an appearance at the University of Memphis last night, but a Black Lives Matter mob decided to go after him and literally chase him off the university campus. Ben Dieter was there because Ben is our friend, a reporter for the great affiliate station we've got, the mighty 990 KWAM in Memphis. Ben, welcome back to the program.
Lars, it's fantastic to be with you. We enjoy you here in Memphis.
Well, thank you very much for that. So you were at this event last night. Describe what happened.
It was crazy. And Lars, I'll set the scene for you quickly. You've got BLM students outside the event center where Kyle Rittenhouse was expecting to take the stage. He ultimately did. That was all at about 7 o'clock. Kyle got to the stage at 7:20. Now, deviously, a lot of those students got tickets the right way, and they plan to either walk out or not show up at the event at all. So you had about 20 conservative students that were good actors, and the rest of the 300-seat auditorium was filled for the rest of the protesters, these students. About 50% of those did not show up. The rest of them did, and poor Kyle couldn't get a word in edgewise. He took to the stage about 20 minutes after 7. He said, "Hi, I'm Kyle Rittenhouse," and they did not shut up until he ultimately cut that speech short after 1 minute, and then he tried to take a couple questions.
Kyle Rittenhouse, by the way, is the young man who, during the summer of 2020, ended up shooting 3 people. He killed 2 of them, and I don't think he ever should have been put on trial. He was. It was found that he had killed in self-defense, and a jury cleared him of the charges. And yet he shows up at the University of Memphis to make remarks, and this crowd simply would not let him even speak. That's the bottom line, right, Ben?
That's correct. And if I had a dime for every time I heard one of these misguided and miseducated students say, "Kyle Rittenhouse shot not only 2 people, but 3 people, but black people," Lars. I kept on hearing that. This guy kills black people. Mind you, this is all taking place in a city with one of the highest homicide records in the nation. That's Memphis, Tennessee. And the majority of those crimes are black on black. Now, after Kyle was whisked away from the stage by his security team, that is when the TPUSA organizers walked outside the auditorium into that audio you came back with at the top of this segment. That is when it was out of body to be there, Lars, in this riot, to see these activists hunting down conservative students. And there's videos floating around, and you can hear them chanting, "Go get them, kill them," and a whole lot of other nasty things.
And all of this, I don't understand the point of all this. I mean, Kyle Rittenhouse acted righteously. He ended up having to take two lives, and he was justified in self-defense. That was the decision after what happened in Kenosha. He is now a bit of a minor celebrity for a lot of us because many of us believe you have the right to self-defense. The Black Lives Matter protesters apparently believe you don't even have the right to self-defense, and you don't even have the right to stand up on a stage and talk to a crowd that wants to hear what you have to say. Instead, they try to simply block people from even being able to hear the speech at all?
Well, that's right. And he said multiple times, I'm not here to talk about the lies of Black Lives Matter, because the local media in this city were running the headlines. Kyle Rittenhouse, the darling of the GOP, is coming to Memphis to talk about the lies of BLM. So all of these students obviously are very triggered about that in a progressive city like Memphis. And he gets to the stage and he's like, hey, guys, we're not talking about BLM. I'm just going to share my story, and then you can ask questions. Let's have a healthy dialogue. The problem is, Lars, I think what's happening at our college universities is they're places of indoctrination, not education. And it looked like, from my vantage point, watching this all unfold, little cultural Marxists unwilling to listen to speech that they may not like. And you may not love Kyle Rittenhouse, but bottom line, the First Amendment protects his ability to speak to everyone.
And by the way, University of Memphis, just so people understand, is a government institution, isn't it?
That's correct. We fund that thing.
It's a public university, which means it's obligated by the First Amendment. I always remind people, the First Amendment is not a grant of rights. It's a document and a protection of the rights you have against the government getting in the way. Did the university take any action to try to control this mob?
No, and that's what really is so frustrating for the conservative students on campus. Now, TPUSA has released a statement, Lars. They released it a couple hours before this event, where TPUSA had worked with their own ticketing system. Get this, over 22,000 tickets went off the market just like that. Now, a lot of those would have been protesters, but they did have a lot of conservatives in the city wanting to hear Kyle. The day of the event, the University of Memphis commandeers the entire ticketing system. So many of our listeners here in Memphis that thought they had tickets showed up that night, and they were ineligible to walk into that event.
So, oh, hold on. So hold on, Ben, this gets worse than I thought it was just from reading the reports. So you're telling me a government agency, the University of Memphis, stepped in, interceded, took control of the ticketing, and locked conservatives who wanted to hear Kyle Rittenhouse out while not locking out the people who were there just to silence him?
That's correct, and that's why a lot of people believe it was orchestrated. Now, they were generous to give TPUSA students 8 seats in the front, only 8 out of an auditorium of 300, and they zapped that out to all of their radical, their student body who were waiting for those tickets to go live at 9 o'clock. That would have been yesterday morning. The rest of the city of Memphis had no idea about it, and that's why we saw what we saw last night.
I'm talking to Ben Dieter. He's a reporter for our great affiliate station in Memphis, Tennessee, the Mighty 990 KWM. The thing that bothers me most about this is government is taking a role in silencing free speech and aiding and abetting political activists and mobs simply because they side with the left. And I see that very clearly. I wish somebody would file a civil rights complaint against the University of Memphis.
And there's discussions that that might ultimately happen. I think at the end of the day, there is a slim silver lining here. And it's for the folks in the Bible Belt, we realize that this radical indoctrination is not just taking place in New York and California, Lars. It's happening right here in the Bible Belt. And we all saw that. That was exposed last night. And that is a very good thing.
You know, wouldn't it be nice if Black Lives Matter would actually acknowledge that if Black Lives truly matter, they'd take note of what you mentioned, and that is black-on-black violence, and the victims there are the people who are murdered. And the fact that they are predominantly murdered nationwide and in Memphis by other black Americans, criminals, that should mean a lot. But Black Lives Matter is clearly just acting as a political actor. That's Ben Dieter from KWAM. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I want to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. In a moment, I want to talk about Joe Biden's new EPA rules that threaten to wreck America's auto industry, one of the most successful industries in the world, and yet Joe Biden wants to lay waste to the place. And in fact, he's going to do a job on United Auto Workers. A lot of them are going to lose their jobs if Joe Biden gets his wishes. But first, I want to grab some calls. Ron is on the line. Hey, Ron, you heard me talking about Kyle Rittenhouse and the kind of lousy reception that he got in Memphis, Tennessee, when he merely tried to get on a stage and tell his story. What should we make of that?
What I make of it, Lars, is that basically it's a form of censorship. This is the beginning of, in my opinion, to try to shut down further conservative freedoms of speech. And them to segregate the people out at University of Memphis, where my first false father went to school, is shameful, dishonorable. It should be just based on the on your character. And he was out to give a speech if they and he was willing to listen. He just came out. He was out in Oregon just last Friday and Saturday. Lars, the man, young man has more intelligence and knows his history, and he's very gentle and respectful and willing to listen to all sides. But when you got people that's funded by Black Lives for Mansions, by that group, I won't say they because they don't care about the matters of individuality.
I think BLM, my personal opinion, Ron, is you said it right, Black Lives for Mansions, because that group has been a scam group for a long time. An awful lot of the money that they got out of big corporations and individual donors ended up going to living a large lifestyle by people from BLM, the BLM the average folks who believed in the message of BLM. I don't happen to believe in the message, but I gotta tell you something. This is shameful, that if their goal now is to merely go from place to place and shut down free speech and say, we won't let you hear what this man has to say. And he's not somebody who's shown up with, you know, some crazy message, a Klan message, a eugenics message, you know, some other kind of ugly message. He's there to tell his story about how he went out to safeguard his own town. He ended up being attacked, and he was attacked. The videos were very clear. He shot in self-defense, and that's what a jury, in the calm light of day, looked at all the facts and said, he fired in self-defense. He killed two people, shot three, killed two, and that all of those were justified. And the fact is, he acted in the right way. And I think Americans admire that. And I think that drives Black Lives Matter nuts, because they're out defending illegal actions and trying to shut people down. There's almost no defense for that kind of activity.
No, there is not, Lars. And the point is this. They didn't put no money back in so-called black communities. They are profiting off of it. They're trying to divide everything that you're hearing, especially like the Fabian socialists or the Trotskys and for the Russian forming of communism by Lenin and Stalin. Everything that they're using is dumbing down our kids, and make a long story short, by dumbing down our kids, and throwing incentives, maybe throwing them $50 an hour, $20 an hour in the pocket like they did the protests out here 4 years ago, they got sheep. And all they are is you got a bunch of hyenas.
And Ron, you know, there have been times going back long before George Floyd when there were BLM protesters, and I would go to these events to listen to what these people had to say, not because I wanted to adopt their point of view. I didn't think I could. But I'd walk up to them and say, hey, I'd love to have you come on the radio and tell me about what your beef is, what your cause is. And they would say, no, no, we won't talk to you. And I thought, hold on a second. You want to get the message out. You're out staging some kind of protest. You're marching around. You're yelling. You're carrying signs. You clearly have a message that you want to get out. I'm offering you a platform on which you can get that message out, and you don't want to talk about it. It suggests to me that they don't even believe the things that they're saying. They just seem to like to act like a mob. Show up, silence somebody, keep them from speaking, and that's pretty much the end of it. Ron, thanks very much for the call. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I do want to tell you this, though. I'm very concerned about what Joe Biden has in mind for American industry. And one of the biggest industries we've got is the automobile industry. And what does he plan to do? I mean, the other day, last weekend, Donald Trump got all kinds of heat for suggesting that if he is not elected as the next president of the United States, that it's going to be a bloodbath for the auto industry. Now, I know the left went crazy saying he said the word bloodbath. He said, you know, he's suggesting violence. I went back and watched what Donald Trump said. He was talking about the auto industry, and I think I'd describe it the same way. It will be a bloodbath. And why can I say that? Because, number one, just this week, Joe Biden has rolled out brand new rules, not passed by the Congress, but adopted by a federal bureaucracy that Joe Biden controls 100%. What they have is brand new EPA rules on vehicle emissions. They're going to push the auto industry to go to electric vehicles even faster than they originally planned. And why is that important? Because already we're seeing the bloom is off the rose on electric vehicles. Last fall, I pointed out to you that Ford Motor Company, which had rolled out its signature electric vehicle, the Ford F-150 Lightning. This was a big deal, and Ford made a big deal about it. And originally, they planned to manufacture actually a relatively small number. They were planning to make about 3,200 F-150s every month. And you say, no, Lars, that's a lot. And no, it's not a lot. Americans buy anywhere from 15 to 17 million new cars a year. So when Ford Motor, and the single most popular vehicle in North America is pickup trucks. And for good reason. Everybody loves having a pickup truck. I do myself. I don't have a pickup truck right now, but I've owned several of them in the last couple of decades. Pickup trucks are great. So you say, so one of America's biggest manufacturers, Ford, is going to make 36,000 pickup trucks out of a marketplace that buys 15 to 17 million vehicles every year. Think about those numbers for a moment. 36,000 pickup trucks in a year sold into a marketplace that buys 15 to 17 million vehicles every year. It's a drop in the bucket. But Ford Motor Company last fall said the Ford F-150 was not moving off the lots. So they roll out this signature vehicle. They put all kinds of publicity behind it and everything else, and they announced in the late fall of last year, just before Christmas time, they said, we're cutting production of the Ford F-150 Lightning in half. Instead of 3,200 made every month, we're going to make about 1,500 a month. So in other words, Ford thinks there might only be a marketplace for 18,000 pickup trucks that run on electricity from Ford out of 15 to 17 million cars. If that doesn't give you a picture, there are EVs piling up on dealer show lots and rooms all over America. So what does Joe do? He says, well, if Americans aren't buying EVs, we're going to push to accelerate this even more. Under the new rules, EVs could account for 56% of new passenger vehicles sold in model years 2030. That's only 5.5 years from now. 56%. Where are they now? They're at about 14% right now. So somehow they're going to almost quadruple the number of EVs for sale at a time when Americans are saying, we don't want to buy those EVs. And I think it should be the choice of Americans and not the choice of Joe Biden. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. We're live in the Hoover Broadcast Studios at the Stanford campus. Hoover is, of course, an island of conservative thought within the Stanford campus, and we're glad to come here. You know that Herbert Hoover came from the Pacific Northwest, and I have had people say, but wasn't he born in Iowa or somewhere else? And I said, yeah, but he came as a kid to live with his, I believe, aunt and uncle. They ran a small school, a religious school, that is today George Fox College, but he'd never graduated from high school. He said, studied really hard that summer and made the entrance exams to be the first student in the first class that happened here at Stanford University. So he has strong ties to the Pacific Northwest. And one of the things, no matter what you think of him as a president, here's the path he took. He didn't go to high school, didn't finish high school, went to Stanford, graduated with a meaningful degree, a mining and engineering degree, went out into the world, came up with innovations in mining that were worth a lot of money, and he was a self-made man by the time he decided to run for president of the United States. If every one of our politicians followed that same kind of path, I think we'd have a much better result than, say, lifetime politicians like Earl Blumenauer and Ron Wyden and Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. And frankly, politicians like Tina Kotek and Jay Inslee, who've never really done anything meaningful in the private sector. But welcome back to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Our poll on X question today, does Apple really have a monopoly on the smartphone market? Now, I would say no to that. If you want full disclosure, I've owned Android phones. I owned one iPhone for a time. I didn't really like it. I didn't like the way it operated, so I gave it away to my brother-in-law. But I own Android phones now. I've decided I don't want to be part of the Apple cult. But for those of you who do, that's fine. Apple has about half the smartphone market in America right now. Android operating systems and literally dozens of companies that make different cell phones have the other half. Can you really describe the situation in which one company makes about half of the products and dozens of companies make the other half of the products so that nobody in America who says, I don't want to own a smartphone made by Apple, nobody is forced to buy an Apple iPhone. They've had considerable success. I wish them well for that. But a monopoly? And yet, Joe Biden's DOJ and 16 mostly liberal states, if I read the list to you, it includes Oregon and Washington. It does not include Idaho. It does include North Dakota, and that seems a little odd. But 16 states and the DOJ have filed suit against Apple, claiming that Apple monopolizes the smartphone market. I think that's kind of silly, but you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I got an interesting email, and it came from a young lady. And what she said, there were a couple of these that I wanted to share with you. One of them has to do with Oregon's unemployment system. Now, do you remember when the unemployment system melted down during the pandemic? And a lot of us said, well, you knew it was going to melt down because former Secretary of State Kate Brown had done an audit of the unemployment system when she was Secretary of State. And her conclusion was, this system is ready to collapse the minute it feels any extra pressure from a large number of people who've lost their jobs. It's going to fall apart. And she wrote that report as Secretary of State. She sent that to then Governor, the morally compromised John Kitzhaber, who ended up resigning in disgrace because of corruption in office involving his girlfriend. But he didn't do anything about it. Congress had given Oregon almost $100 million to fix the problems. They had the money. It sat there and did nothing for the better part of a decade. Then Kate Brown became governor. And did she do anything about it then? Nope. And then the pandemic arrived, and they said, oh, our unemployment computer system melted down. What are we going to do? And you say, oh, go back in time about 5 years, read your own report, and take the money the Congress gave you to fix the unemployment system and actually get the job done. Well, they finally, now, 4 years after the pandemic, they finally went out and spent the money. And they told everybody, we're going to have to shut down the entire unemployment system for a week to make this new system called Francis Online. I don't know what that means, you know, why they called it Francis, but they said $106 million is what they spent to fix the system. And I got this email from Shelby Lovejoy, who's a mom. She said, have you heard that nobody in Oregon is getting their unemployment checks? My son is a hardworking equipment operator who got fired by his previous employer when they got a call for a reference check. His new position won't start till late April, and when the state of Oregon switched to their new computer system, it seems though nobody is getting checks. Cody waited for hours on hold, only to be told that everything on his claim was fine, and they don't know why he's not getting checks. Today he stood in line at a local office for over 2 hours, only to be told the very same thing. What's going on here? Credit is being ruined because bills are not getting paid. Can you do some digging? Sincerely, disgusted Oregon taxpayer Shelby Lovejoy. Well, I can tell you this. Every time government touches computers, there is disaster that results. And Oregon has had this happen over and over, and it appears they've wasted another $100 million on a computer system that doesn't work. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
To some of the greatest minds of our time, Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and I've got a great one for you. Imagine being the state of Oregon and having a Department of Forestry that figures out how to take a massively valuable resource like the forests of the state of Oregon and actually lose money while you're operating them. And that's bad enough until the state of Oregon says, and then we're going to make changes that take millions of dollars out of the pockets of school districts that would use that money to educate children. And the guy who knows that issue best is John DiLorenzo. He's an attorney, and I wanted to ask him about what's going on in the Jewell School District. John, welcome back to the program. This is strange. Jewell School District has now filed a lawsuit against the Oregon State Forester and the Oregon Department of Forestry. Would you mind describing to my audience why Jewell School District is doing that?
Well, first of all, good afternoon, Lars. Hope you're doing well.
And I'm doing very well.
For the last 130 years, Jewell School District, which is located in the middle of Clatsop County, has provided quite a quality education to their kids. But for the district, their 145 students would have to take an hour bus ride to get to the nearest school. They're right smack in the middle of a timber community. Last year, the district received about $4.2 million in state timber harvest revenues, and this is an alternative to the normal system of funding schools. And that's because they're right in the middle of Clatsop County, and the local districts within Clatsop County share in two-thirds of the timber revenues produced by the state. And the state then is supposed to keep one-third about to run its forestry program. The state's own biologists and others have, in my opinion, given away the store by negotiating a deal with the federal government that is going to result in so much land being off limits to harvest that Jewell in particular will lose about 35% of its money. But the Department of Forestry has also placed itself in a position where it's now in its own trajectory to lose money. In fact, in 2022 into 23, the Forest Division incurred a net operating loss of $13.5 million.
Yep.
it wants to be a general fund agency. It wants to stick its hand out for general fund money, but for years it has had to run its own and eat what it kills. So we're suing because the Jewell School District, or the Jewell School District, believes that the Department of Forestry is violating its own rules. And those rules happen to be laws. They're Oregon administrative rules that provide that the Department of Forestry must finance its program and break at least even on its forest revenues. And because its third will also suffer, we're asking the court for an order requiring the state forester to either increase harvests so that the department breaks even. And of course, if the department breaks even, then Jewell's share will follow accordingly. Or take the same sacrifices that it's expecting of our district and fire half of its staff.
That works. And let me ask you this, John, what should taxpayers, because this is a dual issue, it's the Jewell schools, but it's also the State Department of Forestry that wants to take, and I don't know the estimated value if you took all of the state forests in Oregon, but only the government could figure out how to take a very valuable asset and run it so badly that they lose money on the operation. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Lars, look at what they did to the Elliott Forest. I mean, in the 1980s, the Department of Forestry estimated that the value of the Elliott Forest was about $800 million in 1980 dollars.
Yep.
And today they can't even sell it for $200 million because of the horrific mismanagement that they've subjected it to. I mean, what we have are a bunch of biologists who care nothing for timber revenue, only care about critters, which are a proxy to just preserve old growth. They are playing into the hands of the radical environmental community, and they have given away the store. And so we want them to realize that the legislature and the taxpayers are not too enthusiastic about funding an agency that, since its creation, has relied on timber revenues, not general taxpayer money. And if they're going to make us sacrifice, then they're going to have to share in the sacrifices too. Hopefully we'll have them in a position to reconsider whether they really want to work themselves out of jobs or not.
And by the way, John, let me ask you something. One term you used, old growth forests. Most of those forests burned back in the 1930s, about 100, almost 100 years ago. Is there anything, I mean, there may be a few patches that could be described as old growth, but is there anything much in those state forests in Clatsop County and the other neighboring counties that could be described lawfully, legally or legitimately as old growth?
Very, very little is old growth. A lot of it's intermediate growth because it was all reforested. But, you know, this is supposed to be a crop that we continue to grow and continue to harvest so our local governments can finance themselves and so the local population can have good, decent ways of making a living.
I only said that because, John, there are people who say, Lars, you want to cut all the old growth down. I said, stuff that got replanted less than 100 years ago is not old growth. And the second thing is, this is about the habitat conservation plan, so-called, about the critters. The problem is, the forest biologists I talk to say, if you just let this stuff grow, and you're not going to go in and harvest it on a regular, and replant it on a regular basis, at some point you're just priming the forest for the same fires that happened 100 years ago, and all the critters are going to go up in smoke too.
Well, not only the same fires, more intense fires, because there is all kinds of kindling on the ground. You know, I talked to my son one time and I asked him, have you ever tried to light logs in a fireplace without any kindling? He says, yeah, it doesn't work very well. Well, that's, once there's kindling though, they all go up in flames. A forest that is not well manicured, is going to go up in flames. The forest fires are going to be intense. And I can't think of a more brutal way of taking endangered species than burning them up.
Nope. By the way, how quickly can you get the courts to act on this? Because Jewell School needs the money.
They need the money. And, you know, I know that there are others in the legislature who are thinking that maybe they should get payments in lieu of these harvest revenues. But The problem with that is that there might not be any students to educate if there are no jobs and their parents all move away. So we're hopeful that we can get the court's attention pretty quickly, and I like to paint the Department of Forestry in a corner. They either increase the revenues so we can have some more, or they lay off half their staff.
And I think that's reasonable as well. That's Attorney John DiLorenzo, who's bringing suit on behalf of the Jewell School District and telling the State Forestry Department, if you don't want to cut it down, then you're going to get cut down. John, thanks very much. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Hey there, it's Lars, and like many of you, I'm just counting down the days till spring. But if you're contemplating selling your home amidst
some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Mi gente, he pensado invadir una casa en United States.
Yeah, you know what? I don't speak that much Spanish either, but I understand what that translates as. That happens to be a so-called migrant, what the rest of us call illegal aliens. And you know what he's doing? He's going on TikTok and other social media. We know his name, Leonel Moreno. And he has an official tag or handle or whatever. He's on TikTok, and what he's doing in Spanish is telling his followers how to, as he puts it, invade American homes, establish squatters' rights, and then make it almost impossible for them to be removed from the properties here in the United States. And there are so many people who are doing this right now. That video has been seen about 4 million times, and people are angry about it, and I am as well. I want to tell you the rest of the story, but first, glad to have you with me. If you want to jump on, it's 866-HEY-LARS on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, I got to tell you, I've had my fill of hearing about tenant rights. I used to live in apartments. I had to rent apartments or rent a house. I own a house now, but I understand there are times in your life when you have to rent a place to live. And I have respect for people who take on that contract with somebody. They say, I will pay you the rent. You will provide me with a place where I can live. Except that during the pandemic, an awful lot of the rules got changed, and states adopted rules that made it extraordinarily hard to remove people. And if you think I'm exaggerating there, in the state of New York, which is where this guy seems to be doing most of his work, he's Venezuelan, so he has a slightly different accent than, say, somebody from Mexico or other parts of Central or South America. And what the truth is that we're hearing today about people who are having their homes taken over by squatters. Squatters move in, and then when the real owner shows up and says, you have to leave my house, they say, no, I've been here 30 days. You're going to have to go to court and remove me. The average time in some states is 2 years to get a squatter removed from a property. Not a former tenant, but somebody who merely came in, occupied the house, and said, I'm going to sit here, and you can't make me go. And then get this, if your first thought is, well, tell you what, wait till the person leaves the house, go back into what is your house, you own it, and change the locks. Guess what? In many states, including New York State, lawmakers and lawyers have worked to change the law so that if you change the locks, you're breaking the tenant's rights. And you say, but he's not a tenant, he's a squatter. He's illegally occupying a property. The fact is, that doesn't matter. Under the law, you can't remove the squatter unless you go to court or he leaves on his own. And if you go in and change the locks, you're breaking the law. And I saw a woman the other night who a video was made of her. She was the owner of a home. She had inherited the home from her mother. She had a home of her own elsewhere. She was in the process of selling the house. And the house becomes occupied by squatters, which, by the way, in case you can't imagine that, that's going to make it really hard to sell it. If you say, I'd like to sell you this, and it was $1 million house. And in New York State, in Queens, that's not much of a house. It's an average family home. They cost about $1 million. And you say, well, can't you sell it? What, with a bunch of squatters in it? Who's going to buy that house? And then if you say, well, just turn off the power and turn off the water and turn off all the utilities to the house. Well, people who are friendly to illegal aliens and squatters and the like have changed the laws. If you turn off the power and stop paying the power bill, you're violating their rights under the law. You have no right to stop paying the power bill or stop paying the water bill. So here's what's happening with Linnell Moreno. He's putting videos online explaining how you can go about taking over somebody else's house. He refers to squatters' rights, or what are called adverse possession laws, a law that allows the illegal inhabitant to acquire ownership of a property based on continuous occupation without the real owner's consent. So imagine that. You can take somebody else's property. And this guy is bragging about it. Moreno says he has friends who've already taken over 7 homes, and he says it's the only way for so-called migrants, illegal aliens, to not live in the street or be a public burden is to seize, his word, not mine, or invade abandoned properties. That video has gone viral. I saw it a couple of nights ago, and I found out the story behind it. I'll credit the Daily Mail out of the UK, which has done some great reporting on it. It's been viewed about 4 million times. So he's telling people how to steal somebody else's house. Some people have claimed that Moreno is promoting terrorism, and they're calling on the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. But given that it's Joe Biden's Homeland Security Department, don't count on any quick action. Joe Biden has done everything he can to give this country away to illegal aliens. Squatters' rights exist in law in every one of the 50 states. And serial squatters take over a home. Sometimes families are booted out of their own houses by crooks who are trying to turn to vigilantes to reclaim their homes. And Moreno is believed to live in a suburban area of Columbus, Ohio. With his partner and their baby daughter, he has amassed a following of 500,000 people on TikTok. So he goes online, and here's what he says, translated to English. I found out there's a law that says if a house is not inhabited, we can seize it. He then argues that the law applies to land invasion, and he says, this will be my next business, invading abandoned houses. And then he says, I'm going to continue doing this. He says, quote, my African friends have told me they've already taken other homes. You have to look for the return, and the right to return now is to invade a house. He also argues that squatting is the only way you can't, you know, don't end up living in the street. Well, the other way to avoid living in the street is to actually go out and get a job of some kind. And that adverse possession, technically, it is a form of trespass, but it requires an individual to have the intention of making the property they inhabit illegally their permanent residence. And then, to cap it all off, what they've explained is that under the law, if you occupy a property openly and adversely for 10 uninterrupted years, you can make an adverse possession claim, and if you've paid the property taxes over that decade, you end up owning the home. It kind of reminds me of an old movie that a lot of us saw a long time ago called Pacific Heights, in which Michael Keaton played a sort of advanced, very sophisticated kind of squatter who moved into a property, never paid rent, and ended up owning the property at the end of the entire battle. In all states, a property owner must follow a legal eviction process to get rid of squatters. And as I told you, that process can take as long as 2 years to pry a squatter loose from the property. And if you take any action against the person, if you harass them, if you go in and threaten them physically, then you can be the one going to jail. And that's already happening right now. Consider this as just one more side effect of Joe Biden's illegal alien invasion. And then ask your friends, do you really want to vote for another 4 years of that? You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. President Biden on AI and the weather.
Helping web tech, the web telescope. My God, what is this?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I was watching Joe Biden as he appeared in Arizona yesterday or last night and apparently wandered off the stage at the end. I think the Democrats are going to have to get a handle on this. But while he's doing all that, his policies on our southern border are creating real problems. And now we're talking about real money. I mean, massive amounts of money that it's going to cost because of this open borders policy. Laura Reese is a senior research fellow for Homeland Security at Heritage and former acting deputy chief of staff for the Department of Homeland Security. Ms. Reese, welcome back to the program. Ah, it sounds like we lost her line. I'll see if we can get Joel to reconnect us, but here's the bottom line. $1 trillion is what we're talking about. $1 trillion. So we're not just talking about tens of billions of dollars that are going to be involved. We're talking about gigantic sums of money. The kind of money that if we had an extra $1 trillion in the budget or an income for the federal government, we'd have a $1 trillion budget deficit instead of a two. Ms. Reese, I'm glad we got you back. Welcome back to the program, by the way.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Would you mind telling my audience, how do we get to this, $1 trillion in budget gimmicks and other things that are going to be done because we have an open border on our southern border?
Well, the members of Congress are acting like we're still in the 1990s, apparently. For all the border visits that they have made in the past 3 years, it still hasn't sunk in because they are still about to vote to continue funding this open border madness. And there, in no sane planet should this bill pass. And unfortunately, while this is happening, meanwhile, on Texas border, the National Guard were just overrun. This video is going viral of hundreds
I saw
of
this afternoon.
Male yeah. illegal aliens just overrunning the Texas National Guard. So I hope members of Congress see that video and think long and hard about how they're going to vote on this funding bill.
I mean, at this point, it kind of presents a challenge, though, doesn't it, Ms. Reese? Because you have some familiarity with this because your work as deputy chief of staff at Homeland. But if the Congress says, okay, we're not going to fund CBP and ICE and all the rest of that, then the Democrats, I assume, will say, you see, it's the Republicans who caused this problem because they defunded CBP and ICE. On the other hand, if they fund it, Joe Biden has used CBP and ICE lately to facilitate this massive border invasion. What's the best way of getting it? Do we have to shut the government down to bring the message home?
That's very possible. And when supposedly the government shuts down, essential functions like CBP continue to operate. And it is a draws a stark contrast between what is essential in the federal government and what is not. And I can tell you a lot is not, and that's where we should be cutting across the board. But that's for another day.
Yeah, that's definitely for another day. But tell me this. Essential functions continue, so the CBP still operates, but it operates under the rules of engagement laid down by the president. So if he's told them, don't stop people from coming in, just, you know, make them, you know, process them through as fast as you can, because those are his marching orders, aren't they?
They are. The difference would be the NGOs would not be getting funded, the sanctuary cities would not be getting funded, and that is the logistics infrastructure that carries all of this out. When CBP is done processing someone at the border, they turn them over to an NGO, which then gives them a free plane ticket and off they go, and food and shelter and the rest of the services. And so this bill, for example, gives another $650 million to FEMA for an NGO program, shelter and services, and it gives an additional $3.9 billion to the State Department to assist mass migration. And again, state uses NGOs to carry out the operations outside of the U.S.
Well, so tell me this. I mean, because you're much more familiar with what happens on Capitol Hill than I am, but is it not possible for the House, where the appropriations bills are required to, you know, start, to say, we're cutting out the money to state to facilitate this. We're cutting out the money to the NGOs. We will send you the rest of the budget. And I'm sure the president can then say, or the Senate can say, we're not going to pass it with those two things missing. But at least at that point, you get a showdown, you know, where the American public can understand what's happening. The House is willing to fund the government. They're not willing to fund the speedy entrance ramp for illegal aliens to come into the country. And then it's up to the Democrats. Do they turn down a budget that doesn't have those two things in it, or do they refuse and shut the government down? Would that fix, or could that get us to a fix?
Well, that's exactly what the House should have done. And the Democrats are touting on this bill that they're getting more humanitarian aid and they're not getting anything from H.R. 2, the Secure the Border Act. The Secure the Border Act called for a defunding of the NGOs facilitating illegal immigration. And so this bill is a win for Democrats, to be sure.
So why didn't Johnson, the House Speaker, and the other Republicans hold the line on that? Do you have any insight as to why they would simply ignore this, knowing what they're doing?
I think too many Republicans are scared of the Democrats' line that Republicans will be responsible for shutting down the government. For some reason, the Republicans are still cowed by that. When, you know, as we just discussed, you're not really shutting down the essential parts of the government. What has to operate continues to operate. And then go back to the drawing board and rewrite a bill that does what you just described, which is you fund the proper parts of DHS and State Department, and you don't fund the open border organizations.
I mean, do you think the average American understands that's $4.5 billion whose sole purpose is to facilitate this invasion? And if that's all they hold back, I mean, I think the Republicans should grow a spine and tell the American public, we passed a budget bill that funds the whole government. We're not funding an invasion of America. We've had enough of it. We've cut the money off of that. And yes, they'll probably still come across the border. CBP will let them in, and then they'll sit there and they'll pile up, because you know the Democrats didn't want to see all that video of, you know, 10,000 or 15,000 illegals camped out under that bridge. Well, this is going to look like 50 times that much, because in 30 days, we'll see, what, 300,000 people come in and pile up at the border, no bus rides, no plane rides, no NGOs, and you'll say, that's what you created. Now, they can blame the Republicans, and the Republicans can say, you're right. We didn't want people to invade the country. Joe Biden's letting it happen. We're simply not going to move them off the border. We're not going to do that with the public's money. I think most Americans would applaud that.
Yeah, your line about, you know, we funded the proper parts of the government, we're not funding invasion, would be a winning argument for any party right now. But neither is willing to do that.
Well, and I don't know, Laura, it just drives me crazy. We're in an election year. This should be the leverage point. When you say, Joe, do you want us to tell the American public, you may have brought 300,000 in the last 30 days. They're camped out on the, you know, they're going to look like, you know, a Nairobi suburb, you know, in, like Nairobi Canyon. This giant mass of people, and it will be very sad, but those people decided to violate the laws of my country, and then they come across the border expecting a debit card and a train or a plane ticket and a fresh suit of clothes and some medical care and everything else. We're not doing it. Don't come. And if Joe Biden decides to let it happen, I hope he thinks about how that's going to play in a presidential campaign when he says, yep, Joe Biden let all those people in, created that giant slum suburb on our southern border. That's Laura Reese, formerly with Homeland Security, now at the Heritage Foundation. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Upcoming American elections promise some provocative politics, but be forewarned, the Green Agenda may lead to some extreme rhetoric.
Die, gas pumper!
So prepare yourself by listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This week from the Hoover Broadcast Studios on the Stanford University campus, it is a pleasure to be with you, and I've kind of neglected callers, so I want to get started with a real firebrand. Paul in Woodinville. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
You would lower yourself to going on to a one of the highest institutions of high learning and indoctrinate yourself on a campus like that? I'm shocked. But
lower myself? No, but how am I lowering myself by going to university, and why would you think that simple exposure for a week would somehow indoctrinate me to a different point of view?
Well, that's right. You like to suggest that you're not indoctrinated by education. I don't know what you're indoctrinated with, but let me ask you a question. If there's such a big crisis down there at the southern border, why did Alabama Senator Katie Britt, in response to the State of the Union, tell us this anecdote of a human trafficking story involving a woman? And this took place like 20 years ago when George W. Bush was president, and it took place in Mexico, in Mexico City, which is almost 1,000 miles from the U.S. border. And she tried to pretend that this was Joe Biden's border policies that have caused this situation that happened 20 years ago. You would think if you had something, you know, really ripe, you'd start with that. You'd leave
it.
Right?
I was not impressed. I may actually agree with you for a change. I was not impressed.
Okay.
By the state
thought,
of the, well, I wasn't, but let me. Okay, you got to ask me a question, and I agreed with you.
Thank you. Our conversation is finished.
No, I want to ask you a question. You asked me a question. I answered it, and Paul chickened out as usual. What I would have asked Paul is it reasonable to tell the American taxpayers, most of whom have never spent a night in a hotel in New York City, would you like your tax dollars to pay to fly an illegal alien from the border to Chicago or New York or Philly or Washington, D.C., put them up in a nice hotel, provide them with walking around money? But Paul's too much of a coward to answer a question like that, so I'm going to move to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, long time master this. I'm calling like so many of it.
Thank you.
I just want to try and maybe get you to change your direction a little bit. And by that, I mean,
tell me where you think I'm going wrong, Paul or Jeff.
Okay.
Tell me where you think I'm going wrong.
We all know that Joe Biden can't carry on four sentences without help.
And we talk about that almost every single day, so we agree
exactly
on that. Where am I going wrong is what I
asked. What I would like to see you do is get on the radio a little more often and tell the
American
people.
I'm on the radio 6 hours a day. How much more often do you want me to be on?
No, tell the people who's really pulling the strings.
I've done this dozens of times. Do I think Obama is running the show? Yes, I do. And how is he doing that? Most of Joe Biden's current staff, and I've said this, Jeff, at least 100 times in the last 6 months, that most of Joe Biden's current staff are former Obama staffers. And do I believe those staffers talk to Obama? Do I believe the walking orders? But where does that get us, Jeff? Because right now, the current occupant of the Oval Office, no matter who's pulling his strings, is Joe Biden. So if you'd rather have me say it's Joe Bama, and I can call him Joe Bama, and some people do that, but where does that get us in stopping the problem by merely saying we don't think Joe is running the show, we do think somebody else is, and I personally think it's Barack Obama. But if we, and I've said that, as I said, dozens and dozens of times in the last 6 months, but how does that address the problem?
I get where you're coming from. The problem is somehow we need to make the people more aware.
Of what? No, but hold on, Jeff. Let's say we could make If we could make everybody in America agree that Obama's running things, or Kamala Harris, God forbid, is running things, or Joe. When they all know that, what will that change?
I see where you're coming from.
Okay, now, I will give you something that you can change. Ask your fellow Americans who plan to vote for Joe Biden, do you want this country to be overrun in an invasion that already numbers around 10 million? And if they say, well, there haven't been that many, you say, well, that number comes from members of Congress and Customs and Border Protection. Those are two solid sources. And there, and say it's 9 million instead of 10 million. Don't even quibble on the individual numbers. Say, are you going to vote for the guy who sponsored and aided and abetted this invasion? And if they say, yep, I'm voting for Biden this fall, then you ask them, you're voting for another 10 million or 12 million to come in the 4 years after this? And if you start demanding that answer of your friends and say to them, I want to know, do you want the country to be overrun? I mean, we're already seeing big cities say we need tens of billions of dollars to pay the costs of all these people that Joe Biden invited to illegally come into our country, to illegally work, to illegally put their, you know, do all the things that suck resources out of a country that doesn't have the resources to spare. Our federal government's already broke, and you just heard Laura Reese talk about the fact that State Department is getting $3.9 billion to speed the entry of millions of illegal aliens, right? That can change something. But the way you change it is you demand of current members of Congress, take that money out of the budget right now, and if it takes a government shutdown to make it happen, so be it. And then vote for somebody other than Joe Biden. I would suggest the right choice is Donald Trump. And you've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.